Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey, Yana, 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 hey,
they tried to colonize us, tried to genocide us, yet we're still here with the tongue unbroken.
Atlan gunal chisho e chalta kat yuhan, achtu yak e wujin chasati yayagi. Kehne tekhin khanakawani just a cut at the singit aya singit khusti khawasa atune achitin aya kain kakinik. Welcome to the Tongue Unbroken, folks. I'm so glad that we are together. One time Nora Marks Downhauer kehne, she told me, you could tell the entire history of Tlingit people through our songs. And from long time ago, we've had incredible storytellers who've been among us, who have kept stories going without needing to ever write anything down, which is amazing. There was this one speaker who told me, I could tell you a story that takes 10 days to tell. And I was blown away. But now we have taken our storytelling and our songwriting into all kinds of different directions, all kinds of different media. And I'm so happy today to have two of my close friends and people I just admire so much
even though they tease me maybe a little too much sometimes, but Vera Bedard and Ed Littlefield are here, and they are wonderful people who are involved in storytelling, music, and we got a project that we're going to talk about in a little bit that we've been working on. It's very sneaky and secretive, and I think it's going to be amazing. Although I should be careful because we're the ones working on it. But I was just blown away by the collaboration of everybody and how these visions have come to be in terms of the visual representation, the song, the audio, the singing. It's just incredible. So I'm excited about this episode, and I want to hear from you folks. Could you tell the people who you are and what kinds of creative things you do?
Yes. Good. I so appreciate you having us both here. Vera Starbird, Vera Bedard, as Hune mentioned, my married name is Vera Bedard. My professional name is Vera Starbird. My Klingit name is Tekwe. I'm trying for as many as I can in true Klingit fashion. I am Klingit and Danina from the Flinady clan. I was born in Craig, but I actually grew up all over Alaska. My dad was an Alaska state trooper, so we would spend 1 year here, 1 year there, sort of a Alaska version of a military brat. So I got to see a lot of Alaska that way. I am an editor, a playwright, a librettist now, an opera writer. I am a TV writer, journalism. I'll do it all. Anything to do with writing. I'm always excited to try something new. I am right now sort of all of those things at once. I'm just a professional writer is usually what I'll tell people.
Cheesh. And Ed?
My name is Shakindus Tu and Ed Littlefield. I was born and raised in Sheetka, Sitka, and I grew up being brought to the Sitka Native Education Program classes for years. And I was lucky enough to have great teachers such as Kath Utk, Charlie Joseph, and Das Dia, Ethel McKinnon, helped me connect with Tlingit culture in two different ways. So one thing that I guess different or special or exciting, depending on how you think about it, is that I got two kind of worlds is what I talk about, you know, two ways of learning brought into me. So there's a picture of me and my mom carrying me when I'm like 5 months old in a basket. So I had that when I started. You know, just really connected with the culture and going to kuik and ceremonies. And then when I was five, I actually waltzed into the Search Medical. There was a little like open space over in Sitka on the island. And I walked into about 25 people, kids my age, playing violin. And I went, what the heck is that thing? Like, I had no idea what that was. And I begged my mom, I said, I want to try that, I want to do that. And she said, no. So my brothers had already started that and they kind of, you know, just stopped. And she said, ask me in a year. And a year later, when I was six, I started taking lessons on the violin. And that kind of created not necessarily a divide, but a separation of these two kind of worlds that I'm living in. So I'm still studying with Das Dia at the SNEP program, Sitka Native Education Program, but I'm also doing this way different Western music, which I didn't think they would ever combine. So I started playing violin. I still play the violin. I picked up percussion in fifth grade. Then I went to college for music. And an interesting thing happened in college where I kind of for about 2 years or so, I said, I want to do this. I want to do jazz drumming. And there was no connection between culture and how I grew up and what I did. And it's kind of an interesting thing to think about how I could separate myself like that for 2 years, because I wanted to do something else. And then a friend of mine said, why don't you do a jazz Tlingit song? And I was like, what? No, never. That's not ever going to work. But after having a dream about the hook song and where I was playing drum set and singing the melody to the hook song, in that dream, I woke up, I wrote an arrangement in about a day and a half. And so that started me on my journey where I'm at right now, which is playing music professionally around the country, around the world, composing and teaching students about contemporary Tlingit art and different ways of doing the same thing that we used to, but bringing it into a contemporary way.
And it's so wonderful to engage in the stuff that both of you create. Like, I really love the things that you write. I love your plays. I love the shows that you write. I love your music. And then to just sort of think about this path that sort of got you here, which Ed shared a little bit. And so when I was younger, we had a rough go. So alcohol was a very powerful thing in my family. So were drugs. My parents did the best that they can, and I love them, but we had a pretty rough environment growing up. And so for me, creativity was a way to escape from some of that stuff, whether it was music or writing or artwork. And so I found I would dive into those things to kind of get away from the world sometimes. And then I started to connect with other people who were creative. And luckily, I'd gotten into a college in Minnesota, and then I decided maybe I'll wait a year and just be free and just do whatever. And I have an auntie, Julie Kitka, who gave me a plane ticket and said, go, get out of here. And I'm really glad that she did. But I went into college as a math and science major. And luckily I had a terrible, I don't know if it was lucky, but I had a terrible advisor at college who said, okay, well, you've taken math up to this level, but this is college, so you have to start at the beginning. So he rolled me back like 4 years in mathematics. And I was taking stuff and I thought, I can't do all of this again. I'm going to end up nowhere. And I saw someone else walking along with like giant books of math and back was very hunched. And I thought, I don't think that's really for me. And I took a creative writing class and I just really loved it. And then I went up to the University of Minnesota, took more creative writing classes, started learning about indigenous musicians and started thinking, maybe I could do that. And we formed, I had some friends, we formed a little rock band called Aim Baby. And we played, I think, 3 shows. It was so fun. But then I came up here and then I started meeting other people who were very creative and just thinking about the steps that it takes to sort of develop your own ability as an artist, to develop your confidence, to put stuff out there. And Vera, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey and how you got to where you are, because you're on some big stages and it's really amazing.
It's interesting to me hear your college journey, because that actually surprises me that you even took a year off. In contrast to your math, in your math journey, one of my very first classes, freshman year, was biology 100, not even 101. Like, I looked up the absolute minimum math and science requirements I had to go to be in English. I was actually deciding between like education and English journalism. And the professor comes in and he's like, welcome to dummy biology. And I was so offended. But then he starts going, so everyone in here, I'm guessing, English major, journalism, we got some media people in here. Yeah, this is all you'll need to know to get through the next year of your life, and then you're done. And I was like, okay, well, maybe that's true. It's dummy biology. So science was not my route in. That's all that. No, I think in some ways my journey is when people sort of ask, like, when did you first know you wanted to be a writer? When did you get interested in writing? It's kind of boring because it's literally since I could read and write, 4 or 5 years old. In kindergarten, I was telling people I wanted to be a writer when I grew up. I actually was telling people I wanted to be a poet when I grew up. And like, God bless my parents for not telling me, you know, that's never going to make you a living. They just encouraged it, gave me some, you know, pens and papers and lots of books. And all through elementary, middle school, high school, I not only knew I wanted to be a writer, but I actively wrote. I wrote just a lot. I think similar to your story, arts in school were my sort of routes out of abuse situations, childhood sexual abuse, just trauma in general. And I always went straight for that. And in high school, got into journalism. Freshman year, I was, you know, sort of deciding. It wasn't deciding whether I wanted to be a writer in college. It was, I had at that point researched enough that I knew it would be very, very tough. Even New York best-selling authors are rarely just writing. Almost all of them have the sort of day job, and the writing is the side job. So I kind of knew I needed to choose something to do while I was going to create a career as a writer. So it was very strategic. I think the arts is very dinged for being sort of this floofy, like, I don't know what I'll do, so maybe I'll try this. But and an incredibly strategic sort of route to becoming a professional writer, where now I am paid to write. And it's a dream come true. It's also very hard. Creative writing was still quite a ways off as far as people paying you to do that. That's sort of the highest bar, is like, no one really will just like give you a job in creative writing right off the bat, right? Like, you have to prove yourself. So I did journalism for quite a while. And even those were more often my side jobs. I wasn't a professional full-time journalist until, 10, 15 years later. Meanwhile, one of the best pieces of advice I had in high school, I was following, which I had asked this journalist of the Anchorage Daily News at the time, like, what should I do? What should I go to school for? You know, like, if this is what I want to do, like, what should I take classes in? And he goes, you know what? You just need to know everything about everything. And it was such a, well, that sucks. That's not good advice. Like, that's not possible. But I actually understand what he means now. And it's not so much that I know everything about everything, but just, you have to be curious. If you are interested in this thing, go learn everything about it. And so many of the sort of like side quests in my life became tools, became resources, became huge parts of my life. So for instance, I was a Head Start teacher and a nanny for quite a few years. And how does that relate to writing? At the time, that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking of, you know, paying rent. But then working and writing for Molly of Denali, which is on PBS Kids, and they use, you know, these really intense, actually, sometimes learning requirements and educational requirements for it. And you do need to understand how to write for children. That all came in handy, really. Like, all of that, getting my child development associates was absolutely worth it in my writing career. And not just for Molly, for several other things. So in some ways, it was roundabout. I sort of like went through all of these other jobs. Public relations was massively, massively useful. I did that for 8 years, and it was hugely useful for what I do now. It was all these roundabout ways. And then finally, the start of my being paid to just be a creative writer was I saw an ad on Facebook for an Alaska Native Playwright Project, which is they were just going to give you a year. You were required to write a play, a full-length play during that time, and you'd have a mentor. And at the time, I just finished my book. I wrote a novel, and I wasn't really happy with the dialogue. And so this is very me. This is like the very nerd part of me of like, oh, I know, I'll go into a year-long thing of learning how to write a play just so I can do better dialogue so my book can be better. And that was all I really wanted to do with that. I had no interest actually in theater. Like, I thought it was very much for extroverted people who liked being on stage. And for the most part, honestly, it is. But not the playwright. And so I went into that. I met my mentor, Larissa Fasthorse. I met quite a few other amazing professional playwrights and actors. And I, for some reason, chose to write about my childhood sexual abuse as my first run at the gate. And boy, that I ended up having to sort of live in that for the next couple of years. That choice, I go, what was I thinking? It was a rough year, but it was also incredibly transformative. At the end of that year, I had decided actually in that first, there was a 10-day intensive to start that year off. In that 10-day intensive, I decided I was going to be quitting my job and just pursuing it full time. Like, it was time. I was ready. So I sort of premiered my little workshopped play, and that's all I ever thought I was going to do with it. And I knew I was quitting about a month later to pursue just writing full time. But I didn't think anything was coming of the play. The play sort of took off. It went to LA for a workshop at Native Voices. It went to New York for a reading. It went to here to Juno. And while I had never thought it would come of anything, I was hooked. I was hooked at just the workshop process about how these directors and actors and costume and music, they made my story so much better. Like, it was just so much better. And I loved it. I was just like, I thought collaboration, because theater, TV, movies, they're incredibly collaborative, that you have to be collaborative. I thought I would hate it. It's just like, this is my story and you want to protect it. But when you work with really great people, oh my gosh, they can just make that little story you thought was something and make it so much more than what you ever thought it could be. And that's what hooked me, really, was all of these other people that were also loving to tell stories and experts in their own thing. So that was sort of the beginning of the end. Like my playwriting, when Molly of Denali was looking for Alaska Native TV writers, they found out that wasn't really something that existed. But because I'd written plays, they, you know, asked me to come and write that first season. Molly of Denali led to other animation work, which led to TV work, live action TV work, like ABC primetime. It also led into the opera. We're sort of trying these new things. So that's my very roundabout way of, I've always wanted to do this, and yet it's been such a long journey to get to this point. And honestly, even though I knew I wanted to be a writer, I never thought I'd be this. Like this wasn't the dream, because I never knew this could be a dream. I never knew a Native writer could write for TV. I never knew a Native writer could write for animation. I certainly never knew a Native writer could write an opera. That wasn't the dream, because that wasn't what I thought was attainable. So it's pretty exciting, and I kind of love doing what I do.
And you're very good at it. So when Molly of Denali was nominated for an Emmy Award, it was for an episode that you wrote about Elizabeth Paratovich. Some people say Paratrovich. And it was a fabulous episode, and it was incredibly well done, and it was a shining example of Molly of Denali. So for clarity, I wanted to take a year off when I was 18 years old and had no idea what I was doing. And my auntie, Julie Keika, said, no, that's a bad idea. Here's a plane ticket, go to school. And I'm so thankful, because I don't think I really would have gone. I would have just made a bunch of bad decisions. And getting into a new environment was very helpful. And I thought about going the path of journalism as well. But luckily there was more bad luck. And so I had an intro to journalism class, and there were two things that really bothered me. Thing number one was the teacher would say, okay, go read chapter one. I would go read chapter one. And I'd come to class, and she would open the book and say, okay, chapter one. And she would read us chapter one. And I thought, no, is this a bit? Is this a joke? And then I think they said, if you're famous, your life belongs to the public. And I just didn't like those two things. And so thinking about your path on how you became a professional musician, Ed, like to get to not just hone your own abilities, because you're a drummer, like you're like an amazing drummer, and drumming takes, you got to move like all four limbs at the same time. It never works for me. I was like, it's going to sound like this. And then all of a sudden it's just like, bing, bing. It's very bad. It sounds like there's four toddlers who are playing their own jams. And so I'm so impressed with what you can do. And how did you both work on your craft and then turn into this as a living?
Yeah. Sometimes I sound like four toddlers too, so it's all good. That's totally fine. I love the word that Vera said about collaboration. I think that is something that we always have to keep in mind as artists, is that most of the time it's not just us, you know, doing our thing. It's the connections you make with other musicians, specifically the collaborations you make during a show. You meet somebody backstage, and you go, hey, you want to play? And that turns into yet another project. And then all of a sudden you got five or six projects going just because you played a show with them once, you know, years ago. So yeah, I think collaboration with the Kagwantan clan of Sitka was my first kind of delving into that little challenge. And I did write a choir piece. So two different choir pieces. One was in 97 for the 97, I think, for the AMB ANS convention in Sitka. And it took me about 2 months to get permission just to write the arrangement from my own clan. So, you know, we're talking 25 plus years ago now. And so that took a really long time to get that. Once we got it, they said, oh yeah, you have to burn the copies and no recording of it. So I actually don't have the music or the recording of it. Fast forward a couple years later, I wrote a piece for Paul Jackson. And this ties into the opera. He goes, I want a choir piece of Antieli. And I was like, whoa, that would be super cool. And so I wrote that one, and the Sitka High School Choir sang it at one of the Region 5 music festivals. And I was so proud just to see Tlingit people, Native people, non-Native people singing in a choir Tlingit music. And he spoke during the whole song. He was like calling out, giving all the song callings during the show. And it was very powerful. I was like, this is what it should be. And then I had that dream about playing drums and just connecting with some friends that said, oh, you should do this. I was like, oh yeah, I probably should do that. Anyway, and then going on and meeting more people. And so I get to play with a band called Kuik, which is Preston Singletary's band. It's a native funk band. It's got Gene Tagaban and Sandra Segundo in it. So we've got some Tlingit and Haida people in there and Rob Ludgate, who is Blackfeet. And that's one expression that I get to do. Just be having all those other interactions, I get to play in a funk band now. I've also got my own group called the Native Jazz Quartet, Native Jazz Trio, which we primarily do material from our cultures. So I have a Filipino, Swedish, and Tlingit person in that group. And so we do material just from that, from our backgrounds. I also play with the Inuit band Bumua, which I just came back from New Zealand. And it's been a great week down there with the Maori tribes. And I was like, this is just like fish camp, actually. Sleeping on the floor and all that stuff. So it was just beautiful. So I get to play with that group. And now I also get to play with the Julia Keefe Indigenous Big Band. And we're headlining a show in Washington, D.C., a big jazz festival with Esperanza Spalding, who won a Grammy a few years ago. So she's singing and playing with the band. What I'm trying to get at is those connections that I made 20 years ago, working with elders, learning songs, working with other musicians, learning songs, that's what got me to the place that I'm at right now, which is essentially all the groups that I work with are Indigenous groups. And I think that's one of my goals in life, is just to play Indigenous music.
And Gulchish, for mentioning Gachtlein, Paul Jackson, he was one of my Tlingit language teachers, and he was like an OG hardcore uncle, because he would just say something to me in Tlingit, and I'd say, Kaihwasaku, which is, I don't know. And this was pretty early in my language journey. And then he'd look at me real sternly and he'll say, do you not know or do you not understand? And I'd say, I don't understand. And he says, then you say, Kaihwasaku. Don't say Kaihwasaku, because what if I'm saying, who's your mother? And you're saying, I don't know. And maybe you don't know. But then you don't know what you're saying when you say, I don't know. I was like, okay. I take out my little notebook and I start writing it down. He says, don't write it down. You have to remember. I'm like, okay. You know, and so, but it was kind of intimidating, but it was also, there was these high expectations. And the one thing with learning from uncles in that era is, even though they had high expectations for you and they would sometimes give you the business, they were proud of you and they loved you, because he would say, my nephew's going to speak to you. And then he would kind of just push me out there and I'd be very scared, but I would be forced to use the language in some sort of performative way. And then later he'd say, he did a good job. Yeah, and so there was a lot of mileage in these compliments, because it took a lot of work to get there. And so speaking of taking a lot of work to get there, we're going to take a break. And before we do, we're going to give you guys a little taste of something that's coming up, just a little sample. And we'll talk about that when we're back from the break. Chish Tlain.
Oh, godlog. Chotlech away hath kochas kugoch datin. Chotlech away hath kochas kugoch dutin.
Etinik hach gatashinik hat poti. Etinikach yatashinik hat poti.
Of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Akaawe tsuye jagahtune jaltakat yuhan. Ayu katangitin at shi aya wujin at kautilteshi. Akhtu yik e adat. So we're going to start working again, folks. And the work that we do is collaborative. Wujin yejitudne. And we have a project that we've been working on, which I'll ask Vera to introduce and then Ed to sort of talk about. And it's something that you folks have just heard, and it's pretty wild. It's so fun to see it coming to life. And Vera, what is it?
It is a Tlingit opera. And I don't even think we have to say anymore that we think it is. We know it's the first Tlingit opera that's ever been created in Tlingit, the topic being the Battles of Sitka, which most Tlingit people are either at least somewhat and some are very familiar with. But it is two huge battles. Really, it's a whole campaign, but especially two battles that happened in 1802 and 1804, in which the Sitka Tlingits and other Tlingits, as you will see in the opera that I know you'll all see, kicked out the Russians and then had another pretty major battle when the Russians came back for vengeance. And it's just such a ripe, perfect topic for an opera. It's very melodramatic, even in the Wikipedia. If you go look up the Wikipedia version, even that is just like so much melodrama. And we're doing that in partnership with Sealeti Heritage Institute and Perseverance Theater. And we've been working on that for I don't know, like 150 years now at this point. We've been working on this a really long time, but it's really exciting to see it really taking shape now.
Sheesh. And as we're working on it, like, it's been so fun to see, you know, you are the writer, like, this is what you do. So you're the librettist, and it's so fun to see you just sort of like, you vanish, and then all of a sudden you come back with pages, like, look at these pages. It's just so much fun. And then you hand them to Ed, and then Ed comes back with these incredible compositions. And so, like, as we're going through, I'm fortunate to be involved with this thing. I've been involved with this story actively since 2007, when I was taking a class with Kirchne, Nora Marx Dauenhauer, Hoi Nuk, Richard Dauenhauer, and we were translating a Tlingit version that was told by Sally Hopkins into English. And so it was so fun to sit in the room. So we had Nora in the room. We had a couple other speakers in the Juneau area in the room. They're on the phone with Sitka, and then Sitka had speakers in the room. It was just so, even that was so collaborative, because the speakers would all figure out like what they're saying. And it was so fun, because if you knew Richard and Nora Dauenhauer, they were a married couple. They taught Tlingit. She was a Tlingit birth speaker and an incredible storyteller and translator and recorder of the language. And Richard Dauenhauer was not Tlingit, and so he had this linguistic background, and he learned Tlingit. But it was so fun, because sometimes we would translate stuff, and then he would just go off on this like long, wonderful explanation of what's going on with the language. And then when he was done, Nora would say, "That's not right. It means this," you know. And then, so he would get it, and so we'd be sitting there in class, and we studied with him for a long time. And I'd look at it, and someone else was like, "Mom and Dad are fighting." But they were so incredible. Like, the dynamic of them, they were so good. They brought so much to the table. And Ed Littlefield brings a lot to the table. So, like, can you talk, Ed, about, like, how you turn these story ideas, which get, usually, like, we get the lines in English, we translate them into Tlingit. We sort of use the original stories as a lot of reference points and find metaphors and other sort of things. And then you work the music magic.
Yeah. And thank you, Kune, for translating all of that, too. There's a step that was not mentioned in there very much, which is very important, because I get the translation in English, then I get the direct translation of what Kune does, and then I get what it should be. So there are three columns in that, and I really like seeing the evolution of it, because we can direct translate, and it doesn't quite make sense, but then kind of shaping it, that third column is what we actually use. So in an opera, there are scenes just like a theater piece, and there's sort of a story arc, or there is a story arc that we like to follow that makes sense. And that's with the words and the story, but also with the music. So right now we've been working on the act one and building up to, you might have to look up the Wikipedia, after Act 7, something happens. I don't know if we can talk about it, but there's something big. And so that whole story arc, if you want to talk music. So the piece begins with a pretty traditional piece that I wrote based on some lyrics, an intro that we got. And so those words were put into a pretty traditional Tlingit style piece of music. And that's, you know, we've got a verse, we got a melody, verse one, melody, verse two, tag ending. That's a very standard Tlingit form of music. And then as the piece goes along, as the act goes along, it gets more and more dissonant. So the notes get tighter together. The rhythms get more, I should say, less Tlingit sounding. And it sort of builds tension as we go through the act. And then the last scene, is when it's getting down to business, and we kind of have this, it comes back to a kind of a more formal Tlingit style thing. So creating music that fits, creating Tlingit music that is put into a Western art form, I always have to think about my old songs, like the old songs that I've learned, and that is something that keeps me grounded and doesn't let me kind of go off course and to be like, all right. So I tried to make every melody line a standalone Tlingit song, but the additions of other voices and different instrumentation is what makes it different. So we have in our orchestra, it's a small orchestra, so it's violin, cello, French horn, clarinet, piano, and one or two percussionists, and that's our instrumentation. So that's kind of how I go about it. You know, we think about a phrase or a melody. I look at those Tlingit words that are on the page, and I kind of, you know, look at the translation of what it means, and a line comes out, and I start singing it in my head for a little while. And we have to do this kind of quickly. You know, it's a kind of a quick turnaround. So I jot that melody down, and I put it in my music program. And then maybe like a day or two later, I go back in and fill it out with that melody with other voices, other harmony, create a background. So it's all based on that initial Tlingit melody for the creation of the first ever Tlingit opera.
We're going to cheese, yeah. So we said no spoilers. And so thank you for tactfully talking around. But I think you did give away the title, which is Something Big Happens. And so I'm just kidding. That's not the title. And so, like, but this is such a fun thing to do. I remember one time, okay, I saw this thing in Hawaii. So we went to this 5-day intensive teacher language training. We hadn't learned Hawaiian yet. And this thing, it was all in Hawaiian. We had a translator with us the whole time. And they were so hardcore. They would get up at 6 in the morning. At 7 in the morning, they would meet and all walk a lap or two around the building for a little bit of exercise and go and have breakfast. And then they'd go get working, have lunch, go work, have dinner, go work. And they're done at like 9 o'clock at night. And then they go sit in these cabins and you know, visit and stuff till 12 in the morning, 2 in the morning. And then they'd get up and do it again. And I was like, how do you guys do this? But one of the things that happened towards the end was they took this Hawaiian story and they divided it into pieces. And then they all did a reenactment of it. And they sat these, they call them their kapuna, their elders, these big time elders sat down as like a panel of judges. And I thought, this whole thing feels intimidating. I know who these people are. They're big time people. But what they were doing is they had to reenact this story that they all knew. And it was all in Hawaiian. And whoever got the panelists to laugh the most were the winners. And they took this like traditional, and as I watched them just own this story, and they were taking it in all these different directions. And it was so fun because it was using modern, they had a hoopty car at one point and stuff. And it was completely sort of taking control of it. And it was in a closed environment. But I bring this up because I came home and I tried to do that. We had this fun story called Raven and Blueberries. It's a fun story. And we start telling it and everybody takes parts and we split into groups and everybody's reenacting it and trying to be funny. And somebody there got really upset and said, that's not how this story goes and you're doing it wrong, and sort of brought something up. And I said, oh, I thought to myself, that's a different story that they're thinking of. And why kill the vibe? Like, this is just us here. So Vera, as you take this story, there's a lot of pressure to, you know, we don't have to tell the story right. We have to tell the story that exists and the story that we sort of envision and see. And there's many different ways to tell this. But how do you sort of balance that thing between like what we know happened and what you want to put in there creatively?
That has absolutely been the hardest part of this. And lots of literal nightmares, you know, about like it's all overcoming for me. Sort of like what I choose to do with it. Because it is a choice, and we could make this anything we wanted. You know, we could make this the sort of like quote unquote Hollywood treatment and over dramatize something. Although honestly, like the real story is so dramatic, but it honestly, the hard part has been what to choose from it. The challenge with an opera is there's only so much story you can tell, because first and foremost, like the music needs to be there. It is a story put to music more than anything. And how I've been kind of seeing it is like, as a librettist, I'm writing the skeleton of this sort of creation that we're doing. And Hune, you know, you're putting in the blood, the circulation system. Ed's got to put all the muscle on. He's got to do all this stuff that really makes shape for it. And you can be sort of singing the same verse for 5 minutes. You know, it takes so long. So it's funny how little I have to write. Like if we did like word count on this, it'd be ridiculous. More of my writing is actually in the description, the stage directions than anything. And having to write these lyrics that can mean many things so that Ed can use it for what he needs to use it for the choreographers, they can use it for what they need to use it for. So it's sort of how do I say nothing and everything at the same time? You know, like how can this, you know, be a double, triple, quadruple meeting if needed, because it's the same lyric that they're going to be singing, or the same verse they'll be singing for 10 minutes on stage while a lot's going on. So that's getting the history right, and then how to do that with such short actual story time for words anyways. There's going to be a lot of story time for music and movement, but very little for words. For my choice specifically for this is actually sort of a tool I keep reaching for, which is, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, like, the main character I've chosen is a fictional one. We're seeing this through the perspective of someone who kind of existed in reference in that there was an interpreter and many interpreters probably involved, but I've chosen like a specific character who would have been there for a lot of this, but who wasn't actually the one making the decisions and doing the action. So she could be involved, but not quite as directly as sort of these big, larger than life, not character. They weren't they're real people who existed and who fought for us and who fought against us. So that's probably been the most useful choice, is that I could put words in someone's mouth who didn't exist and not sort of get in trouble for that, versus if I put them in sort of Kassian, who is sort of the sort of biggest name that came out of this, besides possibly Branoff, the sort of Tlingit warrior who is leading this. We don't have him saying anything. we have his actions, that we know what he did. It's very difficult to actually put words to someone who you know existed and you don't want to mess that up. So the opera is very nice in that he's very central to the story, but he doesn't have to say anything. He is singing with gusto. But as far as him actually directing the lyrics, that doesn't have to be. And it's still ongoing. Like, it's still a challenge as far as wanting to make sure that we're respecting the history, we're respecting the clans that were involved, we're respecting the descendants of those individuals, including, by the way, Ed is one of them, which is very funny. I want to put that in, and we haven't figured out how to do that yet. But it's a really careful dance, and if I've ever say I've nailed it, I'm totally lying, because there's not a second where I've ever felt like I've totally nailed, like, doing the history right on this. This is definitely, like, the most sensitive project I've ever worked on.
So we highly admire the people that we are talking about in this play do this work with respect and love. So if anybody's nervous about this, it is a massive undertaking, but it's also something we're studying. We've already studied the history of this so much. And Ed, you grew up in Sitka, like, you've been around all of the places where these things happen, and also have heard, like, so many versions of this. And so as we do this work, we do it with a lot of care and a lot of intention, just to say, like, this is one way we can tell this story and look at the emotions that are involved in what happened. And I just want to give some mad props to Hoots Elementary in Sitka, which had a name of some Russian dude on it for a while until recently. And it's really nice to see, like, Tlingit coming in and saying, hey, well, instead of, like, some colonizer's name, like, what if we just gave things Tlingit names on Tlingit land? And so it's really wonderful. So Ed, like, as you sort of go through your process of creating the music for this and envisioning how to incorporate all this stuff, what's it been like to see it? Because we had a workshop here in Juneau. What was it like to see your vision? And I should also mention, there's a big team of wonderful, talented people. They're having so many conversations about stuff that's just really helping to make sure this is as excellent as it could be. So what was it like to see what you thought it would be like, and then to see it being performed in front of you and to make adjustments as it was happening?
Yeah, well, I had an insight into what Vera feels every time she puts, like, paper, like a play into somebody's hands and then says, go for it. You know, we spend all this time, months, you know, if not years, developing ideas, and then you let the birds fly and send it up and see how it goes. But I really had an amazing time hearing the language being sung in, you know, in a little different way and with harmonies. And I think that was the biggest change, because I was talking about melody earlier. It's like the melody's there, like you can take that melody out, but it's the harmonies that, you know, the different Western harmonies, you know, that really make it a difference. And so I was just really proud of the group that we got. And you were talking about the team that we've got. Oh my gosh, it definitely takes a village to create something to this. So that was beautiful. You know, I learned a lot for the future writing about how to write opera music for singers and instrumentalists. And that was amazing. I wanted to bring up a line that lives with me that Vera wrote for Devilfish, speaking of how we can, you know, how we're doing our best and we can't not sweat the little things, but we can't let the little things get us down. And there's a line that's always stuck with me, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, but it's not that we get everything right. It's that we don't get everything wrong. And that really is my mindset going forward, is that we're going to ask the right questions. We're going to connect with the right people. We're going to go in there with a positive spirit, a mindful spirit, and do the best we can. And, you know, sometimes we make mistakes, but we know in our hearts that we are doing this for the betterment of Tlingit culture, the betterment of the world culture, because this is, you know, this is amazing for everyone to hear. And it brings me back to, you know, I was not working in theater at this time, but Hune, you did Tlingit Macbeth. And that, you know, when I heard about that, that was like, here's my view right here. And it was like way left field. I went, what is going on? And so this is, you know, we're not doing anything new. We're just continuing what other people have been doing, like yourself and, you know, Paul Jackson, what he wanted. You know, we're continuing that love of bringing the culture alive. And there's another quote that I heard from Kasatk in the 70s. There's a lot of Leguk that I know, children's lullabies. And I always wondered why we would sang those all this time. And I heard a speech that he gave about those lullabies. And he said, I'm going to add a drum beat to these, even though they weren't before. Even though they were never sung like this, they were never danced to. So our children and our children's children can learn to sing and dance. So he made that choice to add a drum beat. So these are easier songs, you know, the less ceremonial meaning. And so I think we're just continuing on that tradition to uplift Tlingit culture and bringing it to a living art form.
Yeah, well. And yeah, Tlingit Macbeth was so much fun, like such incredible folks to learn so many Tlingit lines and to internalize them and to understand the meaning of what they were saying. And Johnny Marks did most of the translation for that. So they sort of took the play and they cut it down quite a bit. And then once they had it boiled down to this essential, they translated. Well, they first started doing it as a cultural performance. It was a cultural reenactment using English and then a few Tlingit words. And then the idea came to translate the whole thing. And so by the time I came on board, I had moved to Juneau, I'd heard about it. And I went, I think I auditioned, and I'm not an actor. I got a part because I could speak Tlingit, and they said, this guy could teach our actors how to say the lines. And so, but you know, I had a few lines. It'll be interesting because they're going to show the film this year at Celebration. And I've talked to some of the actors. We're all excited and a little nervous because I think, I remember one time it was funny because when I would get my lines wrong, I would say a different Tlingit word. And one time we went backstage, I was like, oh, I said this thing instead of that thing. It was really interesting. Like no one in the audience would know. It was in Washington, D.C. But it was just perfect timing because our stage manager came in and said, we really got to work on the Tlingit. It's all over the place. Like right after I said that, I was like, that's hilarious. And so it's such a wonderful thing to be part of these projects with you folks. And I'm so happy that we get to share a little bit with folks. It's coming out. We're still a ways off in terms of when this thing will be hitting the stage, but it's coming along. We had singers who were indigenous to a lot of different places. It was so neat to see so many Native Americans and Pacific Islanders coming together to sing and to hear professional singers too learn Tlingit and at least learn some Tlingit words and to sing them. So we got another little sample and then we'll be right back and we're going to close up by talking about words of advice we have for the upcoming generation of creative natives. So dream it, do it, chase it, work on your craft, and we'll have some things to say about that. So we'll be right back. Kalchish.
But education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
A de awed y lliechie y cysgyd sgyllnig ytsi a tlein at a iahau awed cytysgyd. So the way that people create things is really an interesting thing to talk about, to be creative, whether you're talking about artwork, music, storytelling,
There's so many different ways that people can express themselves. And to embrace Indigenous artists and Indigenous musicians and storytellers, it's such a fun thing to see right now and see television taking off in terms of Indigenous content and film continuing to make strides with Indigenous content creators and actors and writers. And it's just an amazing time to see these transformations. So to think about how we might send messages to folks who are thinking about becoming a creative professional, what does a typical day look like for you when you're doing, when you're grinding the stuff out?
Yeah, I love this question because it's, I think for all artists in general, it's sort of all over the place, at the same time, very misunderstood. For writers specifically, I think it's incredibly misunderstood. And at the same time, it's a complicated one because it really does depend. That's what some of what I love about the profession itself is, that there is no typical day. Like, there's, if I'm, for instance, in a workshop for a play, I'm going to be morning till midnight, 1 a.m. working, like, whether it's trying to get the actors new pages before the rehearsal that day, or meeting with the other collaboratives after they've done that. That's intense. And you give up trying to like eat at normal times. You just sort of like get food wherever you can. It's a really intense time. It actually reminded me very much when I was working on a TV show and I was on set. They would pick me up at, oh gosh, the earliest call I had was they picked me up at 4:45 a.m. and then I got back past 10 p.m. or a 5:15 call the next morning, you know, and it's just relentless. The good news is those are the shorter spurts. Those are a week spurt, 2 week spurts that's just part of life. A writing day, which I will never do. If I'm in workshop, whatever, I'll write those pages, but it's not sort of a writing the bulk of things day. A writing day, Ed was just joking that it's emails. It really is. You got to get emails out of the way. For me specifically, I almost never write during the day. Like, there's too many emails, there's meetings, and I might be meeting on three different projects that day. I might be meeting on this opera, which is immediately followed by a TV meeting, which is immediately followed by a book meeting. Or I might have six meetings on the same thing all day. And there's just no way to, when you're trying to think of story and you're trying to be in it and think on that perspective of those characters, you can't do that while you're being sort of jerked around to two meetings, to texts, to your cat wants fed, you know, like, it just doesn't work. So for me specifically, why I knew I had to quit my job when I did way back whenever, quit my 9-to-5, was because I couldn't do a 9-to-5 with the kind of writing I do. I write, and this actually isn't something I tell a lot of people, so here we go. Here we go, podcast. Actually, I think Ed and Hune know this already, but I write to 3, 4, 5 in the morning. Been known to write 6, 7 a.m. Like, I write middle of the night to early, early morning because no one's bugging me. You know, like, no one's bothering me at that point. That's when I've always written. I wrote that way in school. I still write that way. It's when I feel the most creative and the most safe. And I need to feel safe if I'm going to write things that are very emotionally vulnerable. So my day can look like a pretty boring, like, did you even do anything today? You know? But the night is just me looking, like, there's a reason you don't actually see this dramatized really well in movies. This is writers, it's actually very boring. Like, you're just like looking at a screen and thinking in space and then writing a little bit more on a computer. But yeah, that's kind of a typical day of what I'm doing. Actually, that's actually pretty close to what I did yesterday. And I was up till 4 in the morning or so. And then it's just a bunch of like boring meetings and Zoom calls. Honestly, the meetings aren't even that boring. I should say boring meetings. They're pretty fun. You get to meet with people like Ed and Hune and dream up these sort of wonderful worlds. But meetings, spoiler, is not where artists really want to be. Is it where anyone wants to be?
Yeah, well, good as cheese. And yeah, I can relate so much because we have a ceremony called Ku'ik, and sometimes the Ku'ik will start at noon and it'll go till 10 a.m. the next day or noon the next day, and you're up the whole night. You've probably had three or four meals and a whole bunch of snacks, and you've witnessed a whole bunch of, and you've been an audience member watching this ceremony. And there's a kind of a punchiness at the end when you're putting all the chairs away and you're done and everybody's just really loopy. And then you take a little nap, and sometimes you've got to catch a flight the next day. And there's this kind of lightheadedness to it, but also this real sense of accomplishment. And I feel that same thing if I've stayed up all night, you know, trying to work on something, but then I send it off. And like to just finish something is such a huge part of the job. It's envisioning it, sitting down and doing that thing. And sometimes you got to get up and walk around. Everyone's got their own process, but then to send that off and say, wow, and the sun is up and birds are chirping and I haven't slept and I feel really punchy. But then you take a little nap and it's a kind of an addictive part of the process once you get into that, because it's your habit. And so, Ed, I know that you're a teaching artist, because usually when we're on these Zoom calls, we're like, where's Ed today? Like, what part of Tlingit Ani is he enriching the children of the world and teaching them how to be musicians themselves? So what does the process and the day-to-day kind of stuff look like for you?
Well, first of all, there's no typical day. Let's start off with that, where a typical day could last for a week, and then it could be a totally different typical day for me. But in general, like you said, I do a lot of teaching. So let's talk about that. So in the artist residencies that I do, usually at the school, eight in the morning, you know, and I teach for a few hours. Usually it's not like too grinding. It's not like 6 hours of teaching. More like 4 or 5 hours of teaching. And I get through that, have a quick snack. Like Vera said, hop on that email laptop machine and start cranking away as best I can. And then, you know, I've been trying, like you said, about walking around, just getting up. I've honestly been trying to do about 30 minutes to an hour of exercise, because I feel that actually, you know, just sitting down, I play the drums. And so when I sit on the drum set, it could be for 3 hours and I'm just sitting down, not doing it. You know, it's a little bit of work, but I've been doing it so long that I'm not getting a workout from that. So finding time to get a little bit of that wake up, 30 minutes, 60 minutes kind of energy in there. And then usually when I'm teaching, like when I'm in Occoquan, Juneau, there's a lot of events that I book myself to. So if it's a jazz jam or a gig or a meeting, I kind of do that in the evening. And if I'm lucky in a typical day, I get to practice. So I've got my drumsticks and my practice pad right here, wherever I'm traveling. And if I'm lucky, I get 15, 20 minutes of practice. When I'm on tour with a group, it's usually outreach stuff. So sometimes our calls were like, you know, 6 in the morning, like Vera was saying. It's like, we got to go drive 3 hours to go do an outreach in this small community. And then we're going to drive 3 hours back and play a show at night. And so there's pretty much the day. And it's all spent in a bus, in a van, you know. So I like what Vera said. So we're kind of sounding like it's a hard, difficult thing. But at least for me, what Vera said about those spurts of high intensity is something that I strive on. And I really love that. It's just like, bam, 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 cranking out stuff and finishing things. Like, so I'll have 2 to 3 weeks of high intensity work. But you know what? The week after, I got nothing to do. So I get to spend time with my partner. I get to go sleep in a little bit. So there is a pro with all that work that's, you know, during the pandemic, you know, like we all were. I was on for 3 days. I think I figured it out. It was 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. at night. I was on the computer with maybe an hour and a half break. It was just like nonstop. But then a couple weeks later, I had 4 days off. So that's what I want to share with that is, like, if you want to be an artist, it's kind of cool that we have those days off as well.
I would say, yeah, the flexibility of it is one of the perks. Is like, there's weeks, maybe months, where it's not very flexible. But for instance, I'm available right now. My grandma's been needing to do these physical therapy appointments twice a week in the middle of the day, you know, and that's tough for people to sort of take off their job and whatever. But I'm available. And that's kind of nice. That's also why I don't work right in the middle of the day, is because there's stuff like that comes up. But that flexibility is really nice. And I also want to say something that I feel like is a huge part of my day, writer's days, I'm sure musician's days, is you have to ingest a lot of art to sort of work in the field and connect in the field and know what you're talking about. So literally reading books is a huge part of what I need to do, obviously reading plays, but watching plays, going to Broadway shows is like literally part of my job. Right now, like as a TV writer, I have to watch so much TV, and that sounds so silly, I think, to people, or that I'll watch the same pilot 5 times of a show just to try and glean what I kind of need out of it on a project I'm working on. But I watch a lot of stuff. I listen, actually a huge part of my process is listening to music when I'm in a writing, when I'm doing the bulk of my writing. I have actually songs for characters when I need to get in the headspace of that character. So just ingesting art is a huge part of it.
Yeah, wow. I get energized by these conversations because sometimes when you're doing the work as an artist as well, like there's a loneliness to it sometimes because you got to just sit down. It's like it's just you and me, computer or paper or instrument, right? And there's a real satisfaction to making something, but sometimes there's a real fear that you're not going to be able to do that. Or a lot of the work that I've been able to do has happened because I've rebelled against what people have told me. So when I was in high school, I had a guidance counselor who, I don't know why, but everything I wanted to do, she would say, you're not smart enough for that. Like, that's too difficult. And I remember just thinking like, wait, what? Like, what is your job exactly to just make me feel bad? And I remember I would sometimes talk to my dad and he's like, what do you want to do? I was like, well, I want to play music and I want to write stories and I want to draw pictures and I would just name like all these things. And he said, you can't do all of that. And I just thought, wait a minute. Like, you know, and so I remember watching Lily Gladstone when she got the Golden Globe Award for Best Actress. And she said, this is for every little res kids, for every little urban kids. This is for all the little native kids that are out there. And I thought, okay, you guys are big time and you guys are amazing. What advice do you have for folks? Like, what's your inspirational words for someone out there who's a young person, perhaps, or, you know, they don't have to be a young person. We're not going to exclude our older folks who were there. There was someone who called me the other day. They said, we're doing a survey. We want to know what people think. I was like, all right, yeah, I'll do it. And they said, are you this age or this age or this age or this age? I said, well, I'm the next one up. And they said, thank you. Have a good night. So we're not excluding like anybody who hasn't gone into the field yet as a professional. What's your advice for them? And this will be our wrap. This is how we're closing it.
Oh, that age stuff is cutting hard lately. Yeah. Like when you join those next age brackets up. I have like 3 tiers to it. And one has stuck with me since high school. And it's, to me, it's like the lowest hanging fruit. And yet, seriously, like the reason people say to do this so much as writers is because it's that important, which is you just have to ingest that stuff. Like that's, if you want to be a writer, you need to read a lot of writing. If you want to be a musician, you sure better, you know, ingest a lot of music. In high school, there was a quote that I wrote down that I think of so much, which is reading is to writing as inhaling is to exhaling. And that's very much how I view so much what I do is what I'm taking in. And that's sort of like learning, you know, knowing everything about everything is that it's, I can only output what I've taken in. So I try and take in as much as I can. And in that way, like that's usually given as like, you need to read, you need to write. I find that most people want to do that and are discouraged by it. I had the, honestly, like the huge, huge fortunate experience of having 2 parents who were incredibly supportive of me working in art. And I think honestly, a culture that was very supportive of me working in art. Like culture is highly respects art. And so for all of the sort of negative things I hear about it in sort of Western culture where don't waste your time reading even right now. Like that's such a huge sad thing right now. Just being discouraged to read. Read those comics books. Unapologetically read the comic books. Unapologetically enjoy movies, enjoy TV shows. Just nerd out on them. Like I hope people will just not just do it as this assignment, but if you enjoy that, like that's where that's going to come from. So that's like the most basic sort of advice usually is just take it in. The next one is start saying yes to everything. There's stuff that even now, as sort of someone who gets paid to do this and I can reliably find that work now, there's some stuff recently that like my agent was like, that doesn't pay that much, you know, but I want to do it. I haven't done this before. I want to do it. And I'm not doing it to network. I'm not doing this to see if I can find a job there. I just want to do it because it sounds fun and it sounds cool. And that's where art needs to come from, I think, is just this place of like, whether it's passion, whether it's excitement, whether it's interest and just that nerding out, like it needs to come from there. And in retrospect, so much of my work has come from people who have worked with me on other things and then recommended me for something else. That's how I got Molly of Denali. I had like 3 different people recommend me to them because they'd worked with me on other things. And I have so much of that experience. And then the sort of final advice is like, learn the business of it. Like, it's not the piece that like artists want to really think about because it's like boring and taxes are involved and like you can get in trouble with, you know, the tax get. Can you tell I'm thinking about taxes right now? But as a very young writer, even in high school, I was reading books on the profession of being a writer and how to query and how to get your stuff to agents or editors or what format, you know, they want to look in, what's expected of you. I think especially being an Indigenous person, we're raised in such a different environment of even the art that when you go into this sort of like, quote unquote, like professional writing, artistic world, the expectations are really different and they're not fair and they're not going to be until you get in there and change it, but you have to get in first. So yeah, learning the business of it and the expectations part and like knowing what the assignment is, because it usually is an assignment, whether it's framed that way. So yeah, those are sort of my 3 tiers of advice for people who really want to make it their life.
What Vera said.
Good night.
Good night. I love all of that because as you were saying those things, I could think, yep, I did that. Yep. Yep, I did that. I did that. I did that. Oh, yeah, saying yes. So I'll just say a couple quotes. There's a famous jazz drummer named Jeff Hamilton. I said, can I have a lesson? He goes, no. I was like, oh, but you can have dinner with me. So we went and had dinner, and he just asked questions, and we were just chatting. And he goes, what are you best at? And I was like, oh, what? I don't know. I guess I'm best at big band drumming. He goes, great. Who's your favorite drummer? And I was like, Shannon Powell. And do you have all of Shannon Powell's records? And I went, I've got 22 of them. And this is the time of CDs. So I had 22. He plays drums for Harry Connick Jr. And so I had 22 Shannon Powell records. He goes, that's not enough. And that concept of there's always more that you can learn. He goes, do you have all the live performances? Do you have every single note that he's played on record? So what Vera was talking about, getting those records, and this goes with what you said about books, read. If you're listening to music, if you're a musician, listen to all different types of music. And you kind of have to get to a point where you're just always listening, because all of that information will teach you and inform you your style of music after the while. This is also with Tlingit, specifically Tlingit music. You actually have to listen to the old recordings and get in there. And then there's another Charles Mingus quote, who was a famous bass player, and he was talking about free jazz. And he goes, you can't have nothing without something. And what I take from that, because it was kind of a diss on free jazz people because they were just playing notes. But he goes, you can't have nothing without something. And that something is all of that previous knowledge that we have access to, that we need to pretty much engage with on a daily basis. So listening to recordings, listening to video or watching videos. And I think that is my biggest advice for any field, whether it's mathematics, whether it's science, whether it's the arts, you have to, and a lot of my favorite musicians say the same thing. So whatever it is you want to do, just surround yourself by it. And you will slowly get to that point where you can say yes to lower paying gigs and you won't feel bad about it. And you'll be able to say no to things that don't fit your personal vision. And that took me a long time, probably took me about 15 years to be able to say no, because I said yes to everything, just like Vera. I was like, yes, yes, yes. Actually, I don't need to do that right now. So yeah, continue. And it's difficult work being an artist, but you know, it's a special life that we live, and very enriching and helpful to the communities we visit.
Sheesh. I was once sitting with an elder. We had a class at the University of Minnesota one time where these elders just came in and talked to us. And I remember one of them said, if you're having a hard time, help somebody else. And then that stuff, it goes out into the universe. And so I think about that quite a bit, because
art is such a collaborative process, and writing is a very collaborative process. When we write for Molly of Donnelly, you get a script back with 10 different people writing in their own colors, making their comments about what their ideas on what it could be. And I think you have to be receptive to that and not be offended that someone has something that they don't like something that you had, or they said, that's not going to work. And you have to just be able to say, okay, let's try a different approach. Let's try something different. And to not get so rigid in this idea that it has to be a certain way, but to also understand where your vision is. It's a balancing act for sure, so that you're not so rigid to criticism that you'll never do something different, but also that you're able to hold fast to what you can see and what you know kind of needs to be there. And that's usually a bit of a negotiation. And if you're on the other side giving feedback to someone else, to try and do it with kindness and respect, because maybe you're having a bad day and so your comment comes off as a little bit harsh and you don't know where they're coming from when they're writing this. Maybe this is something that happened to them, and maybe this is something that they're super attached to. And so in all of these collaborative and creative spaces, to just really try and be someone who's always additive as well, and to try and just be supportive and try not to be in competition with anybody. Those are kind of the things that I would think about, and you folks gave such wonderful ideas. And so for you folks who are out there, make the thing, dream about it, do the thing, take those steps, take the risk, continue to think about things you can do to improve your knowledge base of things. Most of the people that I learned the most from, they were never satisfied with what they knew. And when you kind of ask them about it, they'd say, I don't know, I'm still learning this stuff. And so to always be curious and to always be looking for things. So do the thing, folks. This has been The Tongue Unbroken. We're brought to you by the iHeartMedia Network and the Next Up Initiative. And we have wonderful Indigenous voices in Vera Starbird and Ed Littlefield. I appreciate you both. It's so much fun. There's a Tlingit verb, which is teshkeshku, which is, or you could say teshkeshku achjig. That's boring to me. And this is not boring at all. This is the funnest time hanging out with you. So keep being creative, folks. Shtuk anidihin. Believe in yourself, make the thing, and I look forward to seeing what you folks are going to create. Check out the works of Ed Littlefield and Vera Starbird out there. Go look for their stuff, watch their shows, listen to their music. Gunna cheesh, ye owa.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.